Good afternoon. I'm Professor Katherine Pearson, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science. Before we begin, I want to invite you to participate in today's event. For those of you joining us in person, we will come through with question cards. For those joining us on Zoom, as you see here on the slide, there is a Q&A button at the bottom of your screen. Please use this to submit your questions throughout the program, and we will get to as many as possible. We also have live captioning available. To turn on, click on the Close Caption button in the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. Welcome, and thank you for joining us for today's program, Minnesota State Elections. Our guest today is Brianna Birschbach. Brianna Birschbach has spent the last 12 years covering Minnesota politics for various publications, including NPR, News, and MinnPost. She is currently the politics and government reporter for the Star Tribune. She started her journalism career in college at the University of Minnesota's campus newspaper, the Minnesota Daily, where she covered City Hall. Birschbach has also worked at the Pioneer Press, the Associated Press, and the Minneapolis St. Paul Business Journal. I want to start today with a few questions of my own, and then move to questions that people have already submitted and hopefully that you will be submitting as well. As we've been discussing earlier, midterm elections heavily favor the party that does not hold the White House. This year is no exception, particularly as President Biden's approval ratings hover in the low 40s. So midterm elections are a referendum on the president, and that has become an increasing trend. We see that, of course, with U.S. House elections, to some extent U.S. Senate elections, but increasingly state legislative elections as well, even though the president is not on the ballot. It is also important to remember that in midterm elections, vote turnout is lower, often around 20 points, although in 2018, Minnesota once again bested the nation with a midterm turnout of around 50%. Some political scientists, this may surprise our journalist expert here, some political scientists actually don't even see campaigns mattering that much once you take into account all of the other contextual factors, such as midterm election effects, the president's popularity or lack thereof, economic conditions, and the money that the two parties raise, which generally tends to even out. But in state contests, I think it's a little bit different. And so we're really going to dive in today into campaign effects, how the candidates are campaigning in close races, how the parties are doing, and all of those many factors. So I want to start this discussion by asking Brianna how she sees the national context, a context that really favors Republicans in this midterm year, playing out in the state of Minnesota, in statewide races and in state legislative races.
Yeah, I mean, you can't ignore it, right? I mean, as you said, that's a fascinating theory, by the way, that maybe nothing matters, which, you know, if you told that to all the sort of frazzled campaign staffers I'm talking to every day, they'd be like, what, nothing matters? All this stuff that I'm doing all the time. But you can't ignore it. You can't ignore it in state races as well. So much, you know, increasingly over the last 12 years, you really see national politics play in state elections. But as we also know, Minnesota is quirky. Minnesota's weird. We have high voter turnout. We have, have a long history of third parties having some power in the state. I mean, we have people who still split their tickets, which basically means they might vote Republican or Democratic on the top of the ticket, but then down below, they might switch parties, which isn't really a thing that happens as much in other states. So, you know, in Minnesota, the national climate is certainly dictating the issues, I think, that we're hearing. And I know we've talked about this. This is a campaign where it's all about the issues, and there are so many issues at play, right? I mean, the top being the economy and rising crime, which are the same issues you're hearing about on the national level, and you're hearing national Republicans talk about. But then also, of course, in June, after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, that is now, for the first time in 50 years, playing in an election in a way I've never seen it before. But you also have people concerned about, you know, other issues, just sort of, you know, the sort of existential crisis around democracy, the attack on January 6th at the Capitol, and the hearings around that certainly are in a lot of voters' minds as well. So, you know, there is no Trump and there is no Biden on the ballot like there was 2 years ago, but people are also still talking about those national figures, right? People are looking at state and local Democrats, and maybe they're thinking about Biden, not necessarily them. And same with Republicans who might knock on your door They might be thinking more about Trump than they're thinking about necessarily their local legislative candidate, but you can't ignore how the issues and the messaging and the intensity around Washington, D.C. trickles down into every single race on the ballot.
Yeah, and that's, and the point about the issues in this election, really focusing on policy issues in a way that a lot of elections just don't, is really interesting. But, you know, one of the things that political scientists have found through research is that people don't come to these issues with a blank slate. Sure. They come with their partisan identity and view them through a partisan lens, whether or not that hinges on who to blame for the economy, or even their position on the economy and crime and what should be done about it, or even abortion. And so people tend to have motivated reasoning that comes from their partisan identity. And that really tracks in some ways with the ways in which partisans are talking about these issues differently. But then that's also reflected in poll dynamics, where you see that voters sort of indicate that different parties would do a better job with the issues. So, sure. For example, in a nationwide representative survey that the Washington Post did, it showed that Republicans were viewed as the party that does a better job on crime. Mm-hmm. So it's not surprising that Republicans are talking more about crime. Yeah. And that same nationwide poll showed that Democrats are more trusted on the issue of abortion. Mm-hmm. And so not surprising that Democrats are more likely to talk about that. And do you think that because it's a midterm election and turnout is lower, there's a little bit of a different dynamic here in terms of motivating the base versus turning out, persuading voters?
Definitely. I mean, I think that it's funny when I talk to candidates on either side, I say, what issues are you hearing about? And they're saying, well, the first thing, Democrats will say, the first thing I'm hearing is abortion. Mm-hmm. Republicans will say, the first thing I'm hearing about is crime and the economy. But it's a midterm, so they're going to people likely to vote on their side. So they're likely to hear from the issues that concern their base more right away at the doors. So it's been very hard to tell what is actually the top, what are actually the top issues. But, you know, they're saying these are the ones that are going to also turn their base out. So it's fascinating. Abortion is a great kind of to your question. I have really never ever heard Democrats talk about abortion in the way they are talking about it this cycle. It's in every ad, it's in on every mailer, it's, they're attacking Republicans in every race, even if there's not a great reason to do so, or at least a great stated position to do so on abortion. And I would say 2 years ago, 4 years ago, the last dozen years I've been covering this, abortion is the issue that you kind of just hope does no one brings up, because Democrats didn't know necessarily how motivated people were or if they were at all on the issue, because Roe was in place, there was protections and in the Constitution, and they didn't feel like they really needed to kind of test the waters on how people felt about it. But now they see it as kind of the one big issue they can get to motivate their base this year. So they're not necessarily trying to persuade people that they're having the right position on abortion. They're saying, if you care about this issue, we're 100% on the side on the side of protecting access, and you need to get out and vote for us because of that. So I think that's a fascinating issue in which Democrats are sort of pushing aside all the sort of past kind of careful treading they've done on the issue of abortion, and they're going fully into we'll protect your rights, and you need to vote for us based on that issue.
Right, and what we're seeing in Minnesota is, of course, replicated at the national level.
Yes,
definitely. One of the interesting dynamics about Minnesota is this is a very competitive election year in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. 201 legislative seats on the ballot, of course, the statewide offices, no Senate seats, but eight U.S. House seats. Mm-hmm. And it's very competitive, but nonetheless, the vast majority of the seats I'm talking about actually aren't competitive at all. The partisanship of most state legislative seats leans heavily toward one party or the other. And then really six or seven out of the eight congressional seats lean pretty heavily one way or the other, the big exception being Minnesota's second district, but statewide. And then in those key legislative seats that will determine party control, it is extremely competitive. And so can you talk a little bit about the competitive state legislative races and the implications for party control of the state legislature?
Yeah, I think this is the battle that gets maybe not enough attention from people, because it's A, hard to get your head around. Mm-hmm. There are 201 seats, they're all across the state, and as you mentioned, most of them are not nail biters at all. You kind of know if you've managed to recruit a fairly reasonable candidate of one party or the other, they're going to win that seat. But there are about two dozen, and one of the things that we're still kind of until recently, were sorting out which seats are competitive under the new redistricting maps that we had released in February. But what we're seeing is a lot of the same trends we have over the last few years, just kind of replicating themselves this cycle. You have about, I would say, fewer than 24 races in the entire state that are being closely watched and targeted by both sides. There are some greater Minnesota battlegrounds. A fascinating one is in northeastern Minnesota, where we've seen over the last decade what was once a Democratic stronghold. You know, Jim Oberstar served in Congress there for 40 years, almost 40 years. Democrats would win legislative races by 80% or 70% or more sometimes in their reelection battles. Now suddenly, there are only three Democrats left on the legislative battle on the House side representing those seats, and they are being highly targeted by Republicans because in their districts, their new districts, Trump won by somewhere between 4 and 10 points, right? So Republicans are really bullish about their chances to completely sweep and end the Democrats' time on the Iron Range in this election cycle. Democrats are saying, no, we're gonna defend those seats, and you know, these legislators have experience. Those are really kind of an interesting sub-battleground for the battle to control the legislature. And Republicans are arguing it could be decided in greater Minnesota. There's also a few battlegrounds around St. Cloud, which are very interesting. That's always a very swingy area. Because the margins are so tight, we have just Republicans in the House in Minnesota need to win just 4 seats to flip, and in the Senate, they have exactly the 34 seats they need for a majority. But I will say most of the competitive seats are around the suburbs, which is a pretty typical thing we've seen over the last few years. It's interesting sort of where they've landed. That's dependent on retirements, and you know, there's a couple of seats where two incumbent Republican and Democratic legislators were put in the same district. So kind of one of the ones I profiled in a story I wrote over the weekend is in the Coon Rapids Anoka area, where a new seat put a two-term Democrat and a two-term Republican in the exact same district. It's nearly evenly split between Trump and Biden 2 years ago, although it slightly swung slightly for Biden, and both parties and both candidates are out, you know, storming the district, and just seats like that, I think, will decide who controls. You know, if you see on election night, a few Senate and House seats around kind of the northern suburbs start to go one way or the other, it, you know, will bode well for that side. But it's very fascinating. The suburbs always kind of end up being the ultimate battleground in Minnesota because they create sort of a purple ring around the Twin Cities. Whereas the Twin Cities are blue, the rest of the state is increasingly deep red. This is this purple area that is also coincidentally where a lot of people live. One interesting dynamic though is that redistricting did put more seats because of demographic shifts in that suburban core. Democrats say suburban voters care about abortion more than you realize, especially suburban women. But Republicans say they think that they're gonna win some of these key suburban races based off of pocketbook issues, right? Based off of people concerned about.
Well, and those were some of the seats in 2018 that flipped the DFL in an election year that favored Democrats. Mm-hmm. And so now we have an election year that favors Republicans. Mm-hmm. And so they're back in play.
Yeah. And what's fascinating is usually in a midterm election, the about 18 to 17 seats swing. That's a lot of seats. That's how much the Democrats picked up in 2018, largely in the suburbs. I don't know if we're going to see quite a big swing or quite as many seats. That we might see some seats change hands, but I think the margin that decides it is not going to be so large. I think in talking to all the sides, I say, you know, what's your dream margin of victory here? And everyone said, you know, numbers that were pretty tight.
With this trend of fewer competitive seats. But Minnesota, it's sort of worth reminding people that I think it is more competitive because we don't have partisan gerrymandering that favors one side or the other. Mm-hmm. A majority of states either have solidly Republican electeds draw their seats or Democratic electeds. And so those seats tend to be more partisan, mm-hmm. favoring the party that has unified party control. Yes. And that's not what happened here in Minnesota.
Yeah, no, the courts redraw our maps or have for the last 40, 50 years, because we've always had divided government when redistricting happens, which is right after the census. And it's very fascinating. You know, I was pretty interested in, to see what the courts would do. We got very lucky in Minnesota. We didn't lose an entire congressional district really by less than 100 votes or people. I'm thinking of everything in terms of votes right now. But really, I mean, I think if we had, you know, depending on how you looked at it, a few hundred people less in Minnesota versus New York, we would have lost our congressional seat to New York, but New York lost the seat. So it wasn't as intense of a job on the legislative side, and the courts really did take a least change approach. So they really kind of tweaked the lines as they needed around the edges. And that's why we're seeing a lot of the same dynamics. I mean, we could expect in Minnesota flipping control of our legislature and, you know, for the next 10 years, like we've seen for the last 10.
Right. And so in those competitive subset of legislative districts, state House and Senate seats that will determine party control, what type of campaign activities are you seeing? We're not seeing TV ads in these state legislative districts, but what's going on in those districts?
You're seeing some, but not as many. This is not really, legislative districts aren't won and lost based off of TV ads. There's just not, it's not as, they're A, incredibly expensive, and B, you know, it's harder to kind of target the market in by legislative district. But after 2020, Democrats didn't door knock at all 2 years ago because of the pandemic. Republicans still did, although I would say they were dialed back. I mean, both sides are out knocking on doors. I mean, if you live in a competitive legislative district, this cycle you've had a candidate themselves, a candidate staffer, or someone on their team drop off a piece of campaign literature. I mean, really these large glossy mailers are kind of what the sort of bread and butter of legislative campaigns, you know? They're called, we call them lit pieces, but some people call them hit pieces, depending on what is on the mailer. But that is really these kind of personal connections at the doors and these flyers you hand out really can make the difference in legislative races. I know, you know, your research shows that on the national level, maybe some of these activities aren't as effective anymore, but I would say, you know, and you also said Minnesota's different. Well, I think legislative races in particular are very different because they're so close to your local community, right? It can really, an appeal from someone in person, a one-on-one conversation that you have with a candidate or someone on their staff can really kind of make the difference in races where it's not unusual in Minnesota to have a race where it's decided by a few hundred votes. I have to check this, but Kurt Dowd, the House Republican minority leader who could be speaker if they win control, said that the 2018 or the 2020 election was they almost took back control, but it was decided by fewer than 680 votes spread out across the state. They needed 680 more votes toward Republican candidates in different districts, and they would have taken control. And that's worth noting, that has bearing on the legislative battle as well, right? I said 2018, Democrats picked up 18 seats, but Republicans made a lot of ground in 2020. So they just have fewer races to go that cycle.
Right. And so this all speaks to Minnesota as being a pretty narrowly divided state when it comes to party control, sort of our presidential voting record aside. But what does this tell us about the context for the statewide elections, the battle for governor, for attorney general, for secretary of state, the auditor's race?
Well, I mean, it's those things that you said were true in January and February, right? That, you know, record high inflation, high gas prices, rising crime, and just the classic midterm effects of it being a Democratic administration in power in Washington and Biden being unpopular and still underwater in his approval rating in Minnesota. Those are affecting the races for governor, attorney general, secretary of state, and state auditor. You know, it is interesting, as we've seen now a few months of polls, how there's kind of some buckets that are happening. You're noticing there are two Republican candidates running statewide, Ryan Wilson, a Republican for state auditor, and Jim Schultz, a Republican for attorney general. They're kind of new faces. They don't have much of a track record in state politics. And they're largely running, you know, you see them often together at campaign events. And they're the two who are the closest in the polls. And it's sort of this idea that if you kind of put a generic Republican into this environment against a Democrat with a long record, or at least a record of the last 4 years, you know, what might happen? And I think the auditor's race is actually one to look at in particular. It's neck and neck in almost every poll. They're tied. And a lot of people don't know what that office does. So I really think about that one as sort of a good test of this environment. And in the last
party poll, preference.
Exactly. Yeah. In the last poll, you saw Ryan Wilson, the Republican, exactly tied with the Democratic state auditor, Julie Blaha. So, but then you look at some of the other races. Walz has generally led Jensen in the polls. We've seen some of those tighten. I always say with polls, they're just, and this is true of polls, they're just a snapshot in time. We had polls in, Min posted a poll in June in KSTP that showed Walz and Jensen, at least June, May, I think, were the two, were very closely together. Walz had like a slight lead. And then you saw kind of in the summer after Dobbs, Walz's lead widening and mm-hmm. to the point where he had an 18-point lead in one of the KSTP polls, right. Which, was an outlier for sure in the results that we've seen. And then as time has gone on, we've seen that number go down a little bit, or at least tighten a little bit for Walz. But generally, Walz has led, and Secretary of State Steve Simon has, a Democrat, has tended to lead his Republican opponent in polls. So, the candidates, the differences in the candidates do matter in these races, but it's interesting kind of with the AG and in particular, the state auditor race, to see how closely divided this environment is in Minnesota.
Yeah, sort of along those lines about the importance of campaigns and candidates, what do you think that both gubernatorial candidates have done wrong in this campaign? What have their biggest weaknesses been?
Oh, that's a great question. What's interesting about the Walz campaign is he is out there. He's out there doing campaign events, but the press often doesn't know when they are. They're accessible, but they're not necessarily advertising where he's at all the time. And as we all know, because the Republicans have made this a huge issue, he has declined a number of debates, right? Mm-hmm. He hasn't been in the debate circuit as much as he has been in the past. And I guess it remains to be seen if that's a mistake or not, but it's been interesting how not low profile, but sort of controlled his campaign has been this cycle. Less moments for, I suppose, mishaps, saying the wrong thing, something that could easily be thrown up on an ad or could, because he's the governor, start a, week long news cycle of bad headlines for them. Right. But it also, he's someone who he's very folksy. He has, he's a teacher, a former football coach. He has sort of a personable style that has helped him survive tough political battles in the past. And I don't think we're seeing as much of that side of him in a cycle where his sort of public appearances are much more controlled. I think it remains to be seen whether or not that helps or hurts him, but I found it interesting and I don't know if it's going to ultimately be potentially a knock. I think
Well, and it's given Republicans a campaign issue. There was an empty place in the debate, the KSTP debate last night.
Right? Yeah, there was Jensen got 30 minutes of free airtime for people who were viewing KSTP. So we'll have to see. We also don't know yet how the abortion issue is going to play. Right, Democrats have gone all in. They obviously think and they have research that tells them that this is going to motivate their base, but we don't know. We don't know yet if, really focusing on that as a line of attack, how that's going to play out. Jensen is someone who has been much more accessible and available. I will say we don't always know where he is campaigning either. But he is someone who is as well likely to get in trouble by maybe sort of spitballing an idea to a reporter or having an answer to a question that turns into, or saying something kind of candidly in an event or conversation that then turns into negative headlines. So that has been something that has been a struggle. I there were a few weeks where comments he made comparing code restrictions to sort of the rise of Nazi Germany. That was about a week at least long, series of bad headlines. He had said earlier in the campaign that he would work to ban abortion if he was governor, and then he changed that position. So that has been one of the number one attacks. And a series of interviews he did before he got the endorsement have been used in, I would say, millions of dollars worth of advertisements, clips from those, both from the Walz campaign on education and from Democratic groups on abortion. It's a struggle for him to define himself when in this moment, when all of these ads are being using these past interviews, and instead of sort of really kind of trying to keep the message focused, he's had a few mishaps in the campaign where he's talked about other issues or comments he's made offhand have kind of stolen the news cycle away from you. And when you're definitely down in the polls and you're the underdog in the race, you really need to sort of funnel all of the attention you get toward your message that you want people to take away from the campaign.
How do their extreme differences on COVID-19 and vaccinations and how COVID restrictions were handled contribute to this campaign, or is that sort of in the rearview mirror?
Yeah, I think it's in the rearview mirror for a lot of voters, fascinatingly, right? Because this is what really brought Jensen to the forefront in the Republican field, was his activism and his his appearances and his really, he rose to a very prominent role in the party through going to, anti-masking rallies and things like that. But now it's very quiet. I would say in the first debate at FarmFest, which was months and months ago now, it was kind of all about COVID, or at least it always came back to COVID and Walz's management of it. But in the intervening weeks, it's been quiet. And even in our poll, we did a poll in partnership with NPR News and Care 11, where we asked people in the race for governor, what are your top issues? And people ranked the economy, crime, and abortion as their top three. Schools were quite a bit lower down as the fourth important issue, and COVID was just barely registered in people's minds. I think people want to move on. That doesn't mean there isn't sort of like people are sort of internally reeling still from the last 2 years. They're moving on, but that doesn't mean that the effects of it aren't somewhere in their mind and sort of in voting, informing how they're going to vote in some way. For Jensen, if people are angry about Walz's mandates, maybe they've already decided they're not going to vote for him again. For Walz, if someone has heard that Jensen isn't vaccinated, maybe they've already decided I can't support that person. But it hasn't been on the top of voters' minds, I would say, in recent weeks.
So as you mentioned, Jensen was endorsed at the Republican convention, and that sort of generated a lot of press and a lot of enthusiasm among the base. But sort of looking at the endorsement process more holistically, do you think that causes some problems in general for candidates going into a general election, and then for Jensen specifically? I'm also thinking back to how Walz actually, in his first run for governor, was not the endorsed candidate, but then won in a primary.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Republicans and the Democrats do this pretty differently. Democrats often endorse someone, and then there's a competitive primary. It happened 4 years ago. It happened in Dayton's first run as well. And the endorsement is not so binding on the Democratic side as it is on the Republican side. On the Republican side, you have to campaign heavily for that endorsement, because it really has proven to be the king or queen maker in the primary. Republican voters tend to vote for the endorsed candidate. And so you do see problems with that on the Republican side. I mean, as I mentioned before, Jensen, in the lead up to running for the endorsement, had all these interviews where he said things on abortion, things on education that are now being used in all of these ads against him, right? And I think that the rap on the endorsement is that you're running to win the support of a much more conservative subset of the broader population, and that you're going to say things in doing that, and you're going to do things in that kind of campaign that could hurt you in a general election, and that you really need to find a way to pivot in the general election to appeal to a broader audience. I mean, I would say Jensen has definitely tried to focus on crime and focus on the economy and focus on education as some of his top issues since the endorsing convention. And in some ways has been successful at that in his events, but he's not able to undo the comments that he made before he was endorsed that are now being run in all of these television ads.
I want to pivot now to third party candidates. Ooh, in this particular cycle, it doesn't seem as though any are sort of running to win. They're not in a Jesse Ventura position here, but in very close elections, whether in some of these competitive legislative races or statewide, third party votes could make the difference in determining one of the two major party winners. What are you seeing?
Yeah, that's a fascinating issue, because I think just for context, in 2020, Republicans and Democrats disagree about this being the deciding factor, but there were a number of, in particular, we have two major marijuana parties in Minnesota. So we had among those two parties, a handful of candidates run in competitive and were recruited, according to Democrats, by Republicans to run in competitive legislative districts. And in some cases did take quite a few votes away from you know, one candidate or the other, Democrats will argue they're taking those votes from us because we support marijuana and those legalizing recreational marijuana. So if this person hadn't been on the ballot, those votes would have come to us as the party that's out front. I mean, I don't think it's a perfect, it's not a perfect argument, but, you know, generally it's Democrats who worry about these third party candidates more than Republicans because of these two major marijuana parties. But, you know, what is interesting about this year is, as you mentioned, none of them seem to be running campaigns to win. None of them are really high profile names. But also the question about a midterm, not a presidential year, is with turnout so much lower than it is and was 2 years ago, are the people who are turning out actually just base voters for Republicans or Democrats? Are you going to get that sort of big group or decently sized group of people who are showing up to vote in the presidential race and then say, why not to a marijuana candidate lower down on the ballot? I think that the other question is, when everyone is so in their camps and politics is so extreme, you know, do these third parties lose some potency? I think an interesting example is there was a candidate, Corey Heppala, who was a WCCO radio host who tried to run as a third party candidate under a party Andrew Yang had started, the Forward Party. And he was unable to even get 2000 signatures in order to get on the ballot because it's not a major party. So if that, you know, I don't know how much we can read into that one example, but he got in and Andrew Yang started this party thinking that in polarized times, there was an avenue and a lot of appetite for something different. And that just didn't necessarily prove to be the case.
Right, which is so interesting. So political scientists look at negative partisanship. Yeah. And in some elections, negative partisanship, where people are voting against the other party as mm-hmm. opposed to for their own party, mm-hmm. is even higher than this sort of positive attachment to their own. So it'll be interesting to see if any third party candidates make any inroads in this this election. I do notice DFLers talking about marijuana more.
Yes,
perhaps to try to negate that.
I will note in the auditor's race there are two marijuana candidates, so I think that is definitely causing Democrats some. And in the governor's race, I believe there are there's a handful. There's two marijuana candidates, an Independence Party candidate, and a Socialist Worker Party candidate. So there's a lot of people who could pull votes, and in a close election, that does matter, even if it's not as big of a margin as maybe in past years, it still could decide.
It can still make the difference.
Yeah.
And of course, then we're seeing the implications in the debate. Yeah. So with redistricting, mm-hmm. it seemed that a lot of women were either put in the same district as one of their same party colleagues, retired for some reason related to redistricting. Did you see gender effects with redistricting? Mm-hmm. And what do you anticipate for women in the next legislature? So currently, 36% of the Minnesota legislature is comprised of women, mm-hmm. 52 Democrats and 20 Republicans. What do you think will happen after this cycle?
That's a great question. This was the largest class of women in state history, you know, just narrowly than in past years, but still notably large. And we had women in prominent leadership roles. Melissa Hortman is the Speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. Susan Kent was the leader of the Democrats in the Senate. You know, and we had a number of women who led very powerful budgeting committees, the most powerful budgeting committees in both the House and Senate. So when we saw redistricting come down, a number of those women left. You know, either they were paired up with, in some cases, a male colleague, and the male colleague decided to run again, and they either lost in a endorsement battle, or mm-hmm. the woman was the one who stepped down.
Right, but Melissa Franzen.
Franzen was the Senate leader, the Senate DFL leader, and I'm sorry, Susan Kent was, and then it was Melissa Lopez Franzen who took the job right before session started. But yeah, now she is leaving the Senate because she was paired up with a male colleague, and the male colleague was running again. I know a lot of the district, the new district lines were in his old turf, but she was the leader of the caucus. So it was very interesting to see Julie Rosen paired up with and she is the chair of the Senate Finance Committee. You know, there was a handful of women who just, you know, with numbers, a number of years of experience are leaving. I don't know yet how it will shake out. I mean, there's so many, as we talked about, 201 races across the state. I know some of the caucuses, House Republicans in particular, and you know, Democrats in both chambers have said they've really tried to recruit women who fit their district, who were prominent in their communities. You know, women tend to be really good messengers of issues around, you know, the economy and inflation and obviously on the abortion issue as well, because it affects them, you know, more than it affects others. So I do think we don't know yet how it will shake out. I will find it interesting too, if we have a new leadership in some of the caucuses, you know, how many of them are women, because that's important.
Right. Sort of turning back to statewide elections, you mentioned that the incumbent Secretary of State, Steve Simon, is ahead in the polls, but it's still somewhere within the margin of error, and it's pretty narrow against challenger Kim Crockett. You could talk a little bit about the dynamics of that race and how Secretary Simon's national profile on on elections as Secretary of State affects it.
Yeah, that one is very interesting. Simon has been leading in the polls, but I do think that, you know, that one is, it's really going to be a test of sort of how confident people feel in their elections, right? Because the concerns sparked by 2020 among the Republican base have not gone away, right? And that is really the issue that Kim Crockett is running on. That is how she rose to prominence. You know, she has said in the past that she believed the 2020 election was lawless and rigged, sort of terms around she says, because policies were changed to accommodate the pandemic, that there's no way of knowing, you know, and that those changes helped Democrats. And she doesn't believe the results were correct, both nationally and in Minnesota. And that is what helped fuel her rise and helped her get the endorsement, and of course, win the primary. Mm-hmm. And it has really sort of become what Simon is talking about. Right. Whereas in past elections, he's a second term Democrat, so he's largely talked about voting, you know, policies he supports, you know, how to get Minnesota back up. Because when he was actually elected, the 2014 election, Minnesota dropped down to number 6 in total turnout. So one of the big things he talked about in his first campaign is, I want to get us back up to number 1. And he's done that for the cycles that he's been in office. But, you know, I think where he would have mostly talked about those kind of things, he's much more focused on sort of supporting the system Minnesota has in place and defending it. And, you know, if our poll is any indicator, Minnesotans are very or quite confident in the state system. I believe nearly 8 in 10 respondents said they trust Minnesota's election. So that could be something that is helping him. I would also say something that's probably helping him is millions and millions of dollars that are flowing into the state in that race, which is so unusual. We've never seen this before. It's kind of typically one of those sleepier down ballot races. Mm-hmm. But there are Democratic groups in particular who are spending anywhere in upwards of, you know, in upwards of $5 million in the state through election day to attack Crockett, I would say more, but also some ads focusing on defending Simon.
Yeah, let's talk about outside money flowing to the state in general. Where else are you seeing it in terms of statewide races, legislative races? And then this is an entree to talk about the second district as well.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about outside money is it's a lot of it is from, I mean, certainly we have groups that, you know, swoop in from in the legislative battle. We have a Republican committee that focuses on turning legislative races, is focusing on the Minnesota House. So they've spent over $1 million attacking Democrats to try to flip the House. So they obviously see that as a fertile territory for flipping. Secretary of State's race has been huge. You know, in Minnesota, we do, I would say, you know, Democrats outspend Republicans almost in every election. There is a very solid group of donors, and they have they're kind of a well-oiled machine of how they fundraise. Alida Messenger, the ex-wife of former Governor Mark Dayton, a former Rockefeller, has donated a lot of money to a group called Alliance for a Better Minnesota, which is also working with the Democratic Governors Association this cycle to pump millions and millions and millions of dollars into that.
Right.
Race.
So this is all outside independent spending that can't be coordinated with the candidate, but can be spent in unlimited amounts.
Yes. And they can coordinate, outside groups can coordinate with each other.
Right.
They just can't necessarily. So that's what's been fascinating. The Democratic Governors Association, instead of doing their own thing, they've really come and jumped into this kind of Democratic kind of fundraising and spending power we have in the state. It's very fascinating how they do it. A few groups raise all the money, a few groups spend all the money. And it's been very interesting to see how an outside group has decided to really kind of jump into that coordination to try to use money, I guess, the wisest and in the most effective way. But it, you know, in Minnesota sometimes gets a ton of national attention. I mean, 2 years ago, we had Trump here a number mm-hmm. of times. Mm-hmm. We had, you know, Minnesota just got kind of lavished with attention it usually didn't, because Trump had narrowly lost in 2016. So right. He was sort of obsessed with winning Minnesota, and he came a lot. He sent a lot of his sons, his daughter, his vice president. A lot of people came to Minnesota in that campaign, and Biden came as well. But this cycle, it's been a little bit quieter, both in outside money and in like people coming and visiting. Mm-hmm. Although we did have the vice president, Kamala Harris, here just this weekend to do kind of an abortion related event and try to keep that conversation focused there in the final weeks.
We have a great question here from a viewer about the DFL and the Metro,
sure.
and how important it is for the DFL to win the Metro mm-hmm. to win statewide. But the paradox, of course, is that most of the seats closest to the Metro are pretty safe for Democrats. So the legislative activity and the House races, the federal races, aren't that active. Okay. So how do you think that the DFL will do in the Metro mm-hmm. Compared to, say, 2020,
yeah.
when that was critical for statewide candidates? And what will the implications be?
Yeah, I mean, they still really need to turn out people in the Metro, particularly in the statewide races. I mean, Walz is doing, you know, if we look to our poll, he's doing, and as well as Ellison and all the other Democrats, are doing quite a bit better than their Republican mm-hmm. opponents in the Metro. I know Republicans are making some attempts to try to chip away at that support on the issue of crime, but at least in our polls, it looked as if Democrats were really doing well, overwhelmingly well with voters in the Metro, but they need them to turn out in high numbers, right? That is kind of, there's a lot of population crammed into the Twin Cities, mm-hmm. And a lot of them vote Democratic. And to make up for, you know, increasing divides in rural America, Democrats really need to turn out a lot of voters in that kind of power center. I think they hope abortion will do that, but they do need the suburbs as well. They do need to perform strongly in the suburbs, both mm-hmm. for the legislative battle and the statewide ticket as well. It'll be very interesting to see what happens. That's something that Ellison has been very good at mm-hmm. in the past. He was a congressman representing Minneapolis in the 5th District, the surrounding 5th District, for many years, and he was a turnout, that was kind of his thing. He was the turnout machine for the rest of the party because his race was safe. Now he really needs to turn out that those voters for himself, because he's struggling a bit outside.
So if you could say a little bit more about the AG's yeah. race between Ellison and Schultz, and sort mm-hmm. of what the key issues are mm-hmm. and how, and any similarities or differences in the way the candidates are campaigning.
Oh yeah, I mean, this one more than anything is really going to test the crime versus the abortion issue. Jim Schultz, his Republican opponent, is almost exclusively talking about crime and how crime has risen. He's been very critical of Ellison for supporting the ballot initiative in Minneapolis to create a new Department of Public Safety. And he's been picked up a number of endorsements from, I think, 37 now county sheriffs from around the country. I'm sorry, from around the state. And so this has been his issue. He's really attacking Ellison for it, and he's trying to say that he will, you know, his top issue if he wins is to try to tackle rising crime. And Ellison is talking a ton about abortion. They've really been critical of Jim Schultz's past work for a nonprofit that creates materials around abortion. They've been critical of past comments he's made around sort of pharmaceutical companies and abortion and pharmacists. You know, they've really been hitting him hard on this issue and trying to paint him as extreme on it. And the both sides are trying to paint the other as extreme on crime and extreme on abortion.
So this may not be a fair question for you, but yeah. one questioner wants to know, to what extent are the candidates not representing the issue of crime accurately?
I mean, I think crime is rising, right? I mean, that is a fact, and people are concerned about it. You know, it's interesting because crime is seen as a Twin Cities problem, this idea that it's spreading out into the suburbs, which I think there is some evidence to suggest, but I think that You know, some Democrats feel that candidates around the state are using crime in the metro and suggesting that there's crime everywhere when maybe it's not risen in all pockets of the state. You know, Ellison has said he's frustrated that about the way the Minneapolis ballot initiative question has been framed as defunding the police. You know, it would have created a new Department of Public Safety. But it's very easy to turn that into this this slogan that we heard in the 2020 election as well, defund. And that is something that is very easy for people to understand, even if it's not totally representative of what the ballot initiative would do. But, you know, I think that what both sides are doing, or what Republicans in particular are doing, are tapping into very real fears that people have about safety, and very real concerns that their community could see, you know, violent crime next. And that's not necessarily unfair that crime is rising. But sometimes when you get down to the specifics on some of these issues, like in any campaign, it's simplified and sort of put onto a campaign ad or a piece of mail.
Right. And to what extent does the murder of George Floyd, is that an issue in this race?
That's a great question. You know, I would certainly say the third precinct and the destruction that happened in Minneapolis has been something Republicans have pointed to a lot, right? Whereas Democrats are saying, you know, don't, you know, what about George Floyd? You know, what about the concerns over, you know, police who use force and kill citizens in the line of duty? And I, you know, it, but it's interesting. 2 years ago, George Floyd was very much centered in a lot of conversations, you know, less so now because of rising crime. I think it's made it really difficult for Democrats to talk about police reform and changes in policing this cycle. It really just hasn't been a focus of conversation as much as sort of tackling rising crime has been.
We've talked a lot about sort of partisan difference in the issues, but we have a questioner who wants to know about other demographic differences, in particular differences among young people and seniors and other groups when it comes to crime is an issue.
That's a good question. I'd have to check our crosstabs, but I mean, I do think that generally the breakdown is younger people tend to be more interested in the conversation around criminal justice reform. And older voters tend to be more interested in sort of public safety as an issue, sort of what about my local police? What about my, you know, sort of, you know, what are the numbers of officers in my local community? But, you know, one thing I'm really watching in general around is do young voters turn out in this election? I think that is a big question mark. We tend to see a huge drop off in midterm elections from young voters. You know, some Democrats are saying they're very engaged around the issue of abortion, though, and that could help, you know, increase turnout from young voters. But, you know, if they're not engaged, that spells trouble for sure for Democrats. Yeah.
Sort of switching directions, this is a great question about state legislative candidates from a viewer. It seems that state legislative candidates are programmed by centralized House and Senate party caucus leaders, and seldom are campaigns developed independently by individual candidates. That I'm adding, plus all the outside money that can't be coordinated with the candidates. What does this mean for the winners being beholden to their leaders rather than constituents?
That's a great question. You know, I think you'll certainly see examples of I mean, recruitment happens all over the state, right? The caucus leaders are going out trying to find, you know, people who might be good, you know, messengers, oftentimes on the message they want to send. But, you know, we saw a number of competitive primaries, both on the Democratic side and the Republican side, where people said, hey, I'm the better candidate for my community or on these issues that maybe you're not talking enough about, and challenged, and in some cases did win, and are talking about those issues now on the campaign. You know, I that's always a big question. And I'm always fascinated, because I cover the legislature, how many sort of mavericks we might have in the bunch, people who might break with their leadership and say what they want to say and vote the way they want to vote. I will say the trend in politics, you know, not even this election cycle, but in general, is much more party line votes in general in the state legislature. So you're seeing fewer breakaways. I know there are some concerns that if you take sort of rural Democrats out of the picture, that there will be even fewer breakaways, that the parties will really be divided between Democrats and sort of the metro and suburban areas and Republicans in rural areas, and that they'll kind of vote in big blocks on issues because they'll all be very aligned.
Right. And that's a trend, an increase in party line voting that we see at the national level. Mm-hmm. We see in other state legislatures. And we also see party leaders at the national level and in state legislators with more agenda control. Yes. And more power. But I'm also wondering, as you viewed politics since 2010, have you seen differences in the type of candidates that have emerged? Mm-hmm. You know, the candidates that need to get through the endorsement process or the mm-hmm. primary, appeal to the base. Are they likely to come from different sectors, mm-hmm. From sort of political activism as opposed to a different type of career?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. The joke when I came in was that all legislators were attorneys or teachers because they could basically swing the job. You know, it's a part-time gig and you have to basically spend half of your year at the Capitol. Not a lot of jobs are super accommodating mm-hmm. for that, or you're independently wealthy. I still think we see some of that. You know, I think that just the realities of being a citizen part-time legislature, it really just attracts certain people who can manage it. You know, we've always seen people who came up through activism running for office eventually. That's actually a pretty kind of common way for people. Like, I door knocked for years in the XNX district and I never thought I could do it, and now here I am because mm-hmm. you know, I had all these connections in politics and then I decided to run. But you know, I think we need people from all sorts of sectors, and the biggest challenge is a lot of people, you know, people with big families, you know, people with tough, like, busy jobs, busy lives, tend to stay away from that place because they don't think they can manage both. And I do think we lose representation from, you know, certain people who just couldn't possibly manage it. We are seeing a growing number of representatives and senators from communities of color at the Capitol, but it's still definitely well under if you compared it to the population breakdown, it's underrepresented in women. So I think, you know, some of the challenges of the job are always going to make it really hard to have a really truly representative legislative branch.
Yeah, and in some states with full-time legislatures where they work the whole year and are paid to work the whole time yeah. year, do better on that score.
Yes,
and in terms, and it also is helpful in developing expertise.
Yes, yes.
Interesting. One other factor is people could also see the increase in partisan polarization mm-hmm. and conflict between the two parties and think, you know, maybe this isn't
for me.
Even though I want to make good public policy, this might not be for me.
You might feel like you don't have a home in a place where if you talk to the other side, you might get chastised by people on Twitter. And mm-hmm. I would say social media and the rancor over, you know, in platforms like that, sort of this constant, like, the political conversation doesn't just end at when you go home or when you're done with the debate for the day. You know, you have people tweeting at you or emailing you. I mean, email has been around for a while, but Twitter in particular is an increasingly sort of hostile, nasty place. But I think people say, I don't need this, you know?
Right. That negative partisanship really kicks in.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you mentioned this sort of in several aspects related to the campaigns, but that real sort of breakdown in the urban-rural mm-hmm. coalition of the DFL.
Yeah.
Do you see any prospects for rebuilding in the future, a questioner wants to know, or is Minnesota on track to mirror the trend nationally where rural districts, more sparsely populated districts, are just less likely to be represented by Democrats?
Yeah, I would say the last few election cycles, we've seen it, the national trend, right? Mm-hmm. I actually did a story about this earlier this year, and I drove out to visit a DFL candidate in Western Minnesota running for a new Senate district that kind of stretches from the Western border all the way into Alexandria, Minnesota, which is kind of in the central part of the state. So this huge, huge sprawling district. And she told me she had been asked to run about 50 times by local Democrats before she agreed to do it, because it's daunting, right? I mean, the districts are huge. It's a ton of work. And the numbers, when you look at in particular Trump versus, you know, ex-Democratic candidate numbers in the presidential races, it's incredibly daunting. You know, a lot of these districts in rural Minnesota are 60-70 Trump districts. And how, you know, when a legislative candidate looks at that, they think, how can I overcome it? How can, you know, how can I get someone to vote for Trump and then down ballot vote for me? You know, I think the Iron Range will be the one to watch though this year. Watch what happens there. Do Democrats hold on? You know, and do Republicans maybe overplay their hand potentially on some issues? You know, one person said that could be a possibility in terms of making gains, but I think there's hope for them, but the Democrats are gonna have to spend a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of work rebuilding some of that trust in rural areas. And also they need to look at some of the pockets of the state that are diversifying. You know, in Southern Minnesota, there are communities where there are growing populations of people of color and immigrants who are working in industries down there and might not always feel represented by the Republican in the legislature. So they are hoping they can try to maybe make some ground in some of those parts of the state. Rochester, though, not that that's rural Minnesota, that's a greater Minnesota regional center. Regional centers are often places where Democrats can have some say and some representation, but it's not the same as these rural districts that the questioner was asking about.
Yeah, well, I think pointing out the diversity of rural districts as well is important, just as when we talk about suburban districts, you know, suburban can mean something very different. It can mean sort of affluent and white. It can mean, you know, predominantly people of color. It can mean many different things and people with different lived experiences. So this sort of notion of a suburban voter often sort of overlooks some real distinctions within different suburbs. Mm-hmm. We have not really talked about Minnesota's second congressional district, a federal race at this panel on state elections, but it is one of the most competitive in the country. And certainly we're seeing the most ads focused on the second district in Minnesota here in the metro. So what is your take on this rematch between Congresswoman Angie Craig and Tyler Kissner, the challenger?
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to watch. The Cook Political Report, which we were talking about right before we started, has gone the full gamut of ratings for this race. You know, it was a toss-up, and then it was lean Democratic. Now it's lean Republican. So it's been fascinating to watch. And this one is really, again, another test of the climate. And I think, you know, both sides are doing all they can and spending, you know, their tons of national money is coming into this race. So, you know, I think, and both candidates are really focusing on the issues that will motivate their base. Andrew Craig is attacking Tyler Kissner a lot on abortion. Mm-hmm. Tyler Kissner is talking a lot about crime and the economy. Mm-hmm. So you're really seeing this, like some other races, as really kind of a microcosm of the greater national debate. And I think the winner will be the winner of a lot of races on election night.
But this partisan tide will really greatly affect the
outcome. But this is gonna be a competitive congressional district in Minnesota for the next 10 years based on the lines. It's very narrow. It will probably swing with the political winds. So if Angie Craig loses, I don't know if we've seen the last of her. She lost her first race to Congressman Lewis and won a few years later. So, you know, we'll have to see what she does if she loses. And we'll have to see what Tyler Kissner does if he loses. This is his second run. I don't know if he might have three runs. It's tough. You know, Dan Feehan down in the first district was a Democrat a lot of people liked in that race. He ran twice, didn't win twice, and decided not to run again. So we'll have to see.
Right. Do you see the first or the eighth being competitive at all?
Those are tougher for Democrats in this cycle and in this environment. It could be with the right candidate. A lot of people are excited about Jeff Ettinger, a CEO, former CEO of Hormel in Austin, cutting the right profile, but in a strong Republican year, you know, it's just going to be a challenge for a Democrat to cut through sort of on the issues that tend to favor Republicans, economy, crime, things like that.
What have I missed in this conversation that's going on in Minnesota politics as
wrap up? We've covered a lot of ground, actually. Yeah. But it's a fascinating year. Every year is a little bit different. I was talking with someone about this the other day. It feels a little like 2010 in that, you know, you come in with a strong environment for Republicans. A lot of activists are really sort of geared up over issues. You know, in 2010, it was the first 2 years of the Obama administration. Now it's, you know, COVID policies and a number of things. But then you had Dobbs, 50 years of precedent just overturned overnight in the middle of it all, right? Which created what has always been the case in Minnesota, which is just a fascinating stew of issues and probably a fascinating set of results. I bet we're gonna see a mixed bag. You know, maybe one party will score more wins than the other, but they're not gonna take it all.
I was gonna ask if you make predictions.
I don't. Not after 2016, we should all stay away from that.
Exactly. Well, thank you to Brianna Birchbach for a great conversation, all your really valuable insight. We really appreciate it. And of course, reading you in the Star Tribune as well. So
yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
And I want to close with a couple of upcoming events before we give Brianna a round of applause. On November 2nd, Krista Tippett, host of the On Being podcast, will have a conversation with author and journalist Amanda Ripley about her book, High Conflict, about why we get trapped in conflicts and how we can break the spiral. A video recording of this program will be available 1 to 2 days after today's program, and it will also be available in podcast form on all your favorite podcast platforms and can be found by searching Dialogue Across Difference. We recommended subscribing to our podcast so you don't miss any of our event recordings. So let's give Brianna a hand and thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you.